this time as well, we could start with a story, albeit a real story. It was some 2 or 3 years ago that there was a sensation in the western part of India in this, that one of the holy men in India who does miracles, produces ashes, fountain pens, wristwatches and the like by the sheer whiff of his hand, he was given a challenge by one who called himself a yogi. He said, if this holy person has real occult powers, let him repeat the feat that I am doing. And the feat that I propose to do is in public, full glare of the public sight, to walk on water. He said, if this gentleman can do that, then only I shall admit his spiritual attainments. Well, to prove his own credentials, he was asked to demonstrate his own powers first. Number of newspapers and journals in Bombay, they took up his cause, and a heavy pressured news propaganda was let loose. Hundreds of people from outside poured into Bombay. All the whole city was littered with placards, and editorials were written in papers, guides were posted, and it was like a carnival. Thousands of people gathered. They were, suitable arrangements had been made. Tickets were issued naturally. Lot of money was collected. More than Indian newsmen, American newsmen who were present in India at that time, they rushed to Bombay with their cameras and movies. And I should confess, in this corner of the country, I also was a bit excited and was following the movement. And when I looked up the next morning for the bold headlines in the papers, I was disappointed that there were no headlines. But in some corner of the middle page, there was one item that the huge crowd that had gathered for the demonstration was disappointed, because they said yogi, he was present. He did come to show his power. He stepped into the water, and when he put the next step, he just fell down in water. There was a great disappointment, because it was known that he was showing this feat of his in private. This was the first time in public, but a number of friends, number of experts have testified to having seen him demonstrating this power. Later, when the newsmen plagued him and asked him why he failed, his explanation was interesting. Some people said that he failed because of the curses of the other holy man whom he had the temerity to challenge. He dismissed it. He said, I do not know if you would believe me. What happened was that unexpectedly I developed a cold, and it had gone too far and the function had to be held. I had hoped to control the cold, nasal cold, but I could not. With the result that the particular poise in the body which had to be taken by a special process of breathing, pranayama, that could not be done. That way was blocked. That is why he could not make the body lighter than water, which he could otherwise have done. And he failed. There were reports that he tried thereafter, when he was in good health, to repeat the experiment, but I suppose the nervous shock that he had at that time proved to be an insurmountable psychological barrier for any success. Now this incident I am bringing to your notice to underline the principles of Hatha Yoga, which is our theme today. We have seen that the high aim of the traditional yoga of knowledge is to go into samadhi, which is much more than what is called in the West trance. It is that concentrated state of consciousness, awareness, when the mind is completely lost to anything else except the object on which it is dwelling, and a later stage and a further stage of the samadhi being that the mind or the awareness is completely identified with the object. It is no more concentrating on the object, but it is lost in the object. The aim of the traditional yoga of knowledge is to lose oneself in the reality, in the consciousness of Brahman, in which there is nothing else, there is only the One. This state of samadhi is the object in some way or other of the many lines of yoga that have been prevalent in India. One of the main yogas is the Hatha Yoga, the yoga that concentrates on the physical body. The yoga of knowledge concerns itself with the development of the mind and the mental faculties. The yoga of love with the heart, the emotional being, the evocation of the psychic. The yoga of works with the dynamization of the will of man for the attainment of the divine consciousness. The Hatha Yoga aims at striking a balance and a relation between the body and the soul in such a way that the soul can move, can function as freely as it does at present in its subtle causal body. The normal human body, of which most of us are aware, is only a vehicle, an inert, mechanical, dull vehicle to the life energy that circulates in it. It obstructs every upward movement, every forward movement of the life force or the mind energy that circulates in it. The Hatha yogins aimed to so process and develop the body that instead of being a hindrance to the free movement of the mind and life energies, it could support them, give them its strength, and itself develop into a direct vehicle of God. The process of Hatha Yoga is first a system of postures, what are called asanas, physical postures. Now asanas do not mean only physical postures. Originally an asana meant that poise, whether it is physical or mental or spiritual or psychological, in which one is at ease, one is in tune with something deeper or higher that one seeks. That poise is the asana that is most conducive to one's development and progress. Here in this limited context, asana is a particular physical posture which sets the body in a position in which it can stay undisturbed for a while, as long as one wants. Normally we find that it is impossible for us to sit in one poise stationarily. We tend to move, if not the body, at least some limbs. When we sit, there is an accumulation of life force. Either it has to be worked out or it has to be spilled out. In either case, as the life force accumulates, as the mind begins to think, in the body there is a certain restlessness. The body cannot contain. It either begins to sway, rock, or move from side to side. This system has worked out a number of physical postures, some complicated, some simple, by which, apart from the toning up of the physical body, the strengthening of the muscles, it puts the whole system into a kind of immobility in which the body, physical body, forgets itself and acts as an unmoving pedestal for whatever use you choose to make of it. There are as many as 84 asanas or postures, though only about 16 or so are considered to be the main, the rest being permutations and combinations amongst these. Each one has its own period, has its own processes, steps, you may say it, and it is recorded what are the precise benefits from each asana. For our purpose, it is enough if the body is accustomed to periods of immobile, unmoving postures. Second, it is developed in such a way that it can contain any amount of life force or the life energy that is either invited into it or that pours into it from the universal store of life energy. In the beginning, as the energy pours in, there is a shaking. The body shakes. But with these asanas, when one trains the body to sit for a while, concentrated, the body gets accustomed. And it not only can bear this inrush, but it develops its own capacity to increasingly hold more and more of the supply of life energy. Along with the asanas, there is the next step, what is called pranayama. Pranayama is a name for a series of exercises that aim to regulate and arrest and prolong the span of the life movement, the movement of life force in the body. As you are aware, there are number of functions of the life and life force. Only the first function, breathing, is the key to the other four movements. There is the breath of life, as they say, breathing in, then the expelling of the air that is breathed in, then there is the operation of equalization between the in-breathing and the out-breathing, then there is the spreading of the life breath that is taken in equally in all the parts, then there is the operation of exit through the head. The life force is ejected through the head at the time of parting from the body. These are five main operations of the life force. There are five other subsidiary operations into which we need not now enter. Now, breathing, the main and the first operation, holds the key to the rest. By first equalizing the process and the period of inspiration and expiration, a certain rhythm is arrived at. With this established rhythm, there is an automatic improvement in the flow of thoughts, because the mind and the life are intimately connected. If you observe yourself closely, you will find that when you are excited, when the mind, the thinking rushes in a fury, the whole of life force, the breathing is restless. One breathes fast, one breathes hard. Similarly, when one is lost in concentration, in contemplation, in meditation, you will see the breathing slowing down. The reverse can also be true. If by a process, any kind of process, you slow the breathing, you make it controlled, it has an immediate effect and a direct effect upon the movement of thoughts. That is why pranayama has been given so much importance in traditional yoga. We hear people always complaining that when they close their eyes for meditation, there is a rush of thoughts, the mind runs in 100 directions, they ask how to control the mind. The ancients had this precise solution. They said, regulate your breathing. To begin with, equalize the period of in-breathing and the out-breathing. In one of his lectures in the West, Vivekananda gave a simple exercise to the seekers. He said, you place your finger on one nostril and breathe in deeply through the other. Don't hold it. Immediately, the same speed, let it out through this nostril. Then through the same nostril you breathe in, and with the same speed you let it out. 10 times this way and 10 times that, you do at any time, and you will see the result immediately. There is a certain calming of the system. The mind breathes easy. This is the simplest exercise. Then there is, at a later stage, they add the period of holding the breath. You breathe in, you hold it for some time, and then let it out. More than breathing in, more attention has to be paid to the act of breathing out, because one always tends to do it faster than breathing in. That has to be controlled. That has to be slowed down. They have got various exercises, 2, 2, 2, 2, 4, 8, and all these things. The whole principle being to bring the process of breathing, the process of the working of the life force under one's control. With this, the first step, that of purification of the system, is effective. For regular, disciplined exercise in the regulation of life force, life energies, results not only in the quieting of the mind, but in the opening up of the clogged cells in the nervous system. All over the nervous system, there are areas which are clogged, not so much physically, but psychophysically. Emotions, desires, past associations, some shadows of physical habits, all these clog, and the life force is normally unable to circulate in the whole nervous system in a healthy way. That is why there are imbalances in the system, which, when they accumulate, express themselves in physical illnesses. This system of regulation of breathing, regulation of the life force, the breath of life, aims at opening up all the channels of the nervous system and assuring a smooth flow of the energies, not only the life energies, but the mental energies, the psychic energies, the spiritual energies, the physical energies. All these, when they are let flow without interruption, the whole system gets toned up. Afterwards, once the system is purified, there is the next step of concentration. All the energies at every level, they are easier assembled, marshaled together, and poured on the object of pursuit, whether it is meditation or worship or thinking, whatever the activity. All the energies in the system, they are assembled without difficulty and raised to their maximum potential. Third, liberation. When, after purification of the system, after concentration, the galvanizing of the diverse energies and monitoring them to the purpose in view, the third step is liberation. the liberation of the inner being from its clampings to outer nature and release either inwards or upwards in the direction that is chosen. These are the three main steps of Hatha Yoga. At this stage, Hatha Yoga develops into Raja Yoga, and Raja Yoga is essentially a psychophysical, a more psychophysical system than the Hatha Yoga, which emphasizes more on the material, on the physical aspect of the situation. One inevitable result of these asanas, bringing the body functions completely under control, developing the body potentiality to its maximum, the acquiring of control on the life force, the breathing, is not only a change in the balancing of the different operations in the system, but also changing the balance between the forces outside and inside. For instance, as one develops in this line, the force of Earth's gravitation on the physical body is lessened. One can, if one chooses, gets lighter than Earth, lighter than air, lighter than water. You all know, who have read the biography of Sri Aurobindo, how in the Alipur jail, people had seen Sri Aurobindo about a foot higher, sitting in meditation, about a foot higher than the ground. And when he was asked, he said he was not conscious, he did not do it deliberately. He was doing pranayama at that time. The balance had been altered, and the body getting lighter, it just floated up. Normally Hatha Yogins live very much on the physical surface. But Sri Aurobindo, as you know, was always concentrated within. So he was not aware of this physical manifestation of levitation. People walk, people can make their bodies heavier also, so that you can't move, you can't lift. They can make it lighter, they can make it smaller, they can make it huge. It is possible by certain siddhis or accomplishments, achievements in Hatha Yoga and Raja Yoga, to acquire what are called siddhis, the powers of reducing to microscopic size, to magnifying to huge size, to making the body lighter, to making the body heavier, and there are many more. These were the wonders that attracted so many minds, vulgar minds, to yoga and served to debase the whole system, losing sight of the lofty ideals with which one started. And that was why the ancients discouraged, severely discouraged, pursuit of these achievements. Though there is nothing unspiritual about them, they deter the consciousness if one is not vigilant from the central pursuit. After the body is accustomed to sit for long periods of immobility without getting restless, it is also a part of the system with the aid of other processes, to which we shall come in our next talk, to awaken the potent power, life power, at the base of the spine, the serpent power, and lead it up through the spinal column, center by center, till it reaches its highest peak over the head in the thousand-petaled lotus. It is understood that neither this serpent power nor these centers which are called chakras or wheels are located in the physical body. You must have heard of the surgeon who operated upon a dead body and asked, challenged people to show him the centers and the serpent power. Well, all yoga, all occult science is one in maintaining that these centers are not precisely the ganglionic centers with which medical science is familiar. They are centers in the subtle body which have corresponding effects in the physical body. Those points in the subtle body correspond to certain areas in the physical body. That is why when they are awake, one feels their action in the physical body and one tends to believe that they are centered in the physical body. Of these we'll talk in our next meeting.
What would be the length of time useful to our yoga, say daily, that one might spend in one certain asana?
Well, Sri Aurobindo has said that these laborious and difficult processes of the Hatha Yoga and the Raja Yoga, they are not built in this system of integral yoga, though their aims have been kept in view. But they can be made use of in the preliminary stages or up to any stage as long as they are useful. Personally, after having been here for 35 years, having known something of this yoga, having known also my personal experience, the difficulties of hundreds of sadhak seekers with whom I have had occasion to talk, thousands of letters which I have had occasion to read and file from all over the world, I feel that some acquaintance with the simpler asanas and the simpler processes of breathing, regulation of breathing, are necessary to give a good and stable grounding to the seeker. If you see near the samadhi in the ashram, people meditating, you will find 100 postures in which they are sitting. Hardly one or two of them, they are the right postures. They either put their heads on the knees, rest on the walls, do like this. They are dozing. They are not meditating. They are not concentrating. They are just letting things happen. Of course, there is a certain pressure in the atmosphere, and people have the satisfaction, the false satisfaction, that they are meditating, they are doing yoga. Actually, the yoga power cannot function fully in certain postures. The Upanishads are one in saying that the posture has to be erect. They say that the chest, the nose and the eyes, they are to be in the same position. Most important is that the spine should be erect. You see a person who does the asanas, you will never find him stooping like this. He will always sit erect, whether he reads, whether he takes food, whether he sits on the beach and watches the sea, he will always sit erect. And that ensures that the breathing goes at its full speed, full benefit. If at that time there is a descent or an ascent, it is unhindered by the posture. So a preliminary, and also, if we sit normally for about half an hour or 45 minutes, we tend to move our legs, our hands. That is a certain distraction, a minus factor. One must familiarize oneself, practice these, some of these preliminary asanas and postures, at least to see that the physical basis is strong enough to stand periods of meditation or concentration. To keep oneself open, unhindered physically, to the downflow and the action of the yoga force from whatever plane it comes. Similarly, breathing, the breathing exercises reduce the difficulty in meditation of distraction by thoughts, at least by 50%. They also have to be learned. If I am not going to start an ashram at any time, but if anyone who wants to start an ashram were to consult me, I would say, in your course, please introduce these simple exercises in asanas and pranayama. You must have this course. Have you seen a person practicing pranayama? Have you seen the glow? He may not be highly spiritual, but there is a certain glow on the face. There is a certain contentment, maybe a superficial contentment, but there is a contentment. There is no distraction on the face. If along with the gymnastic and the physical cultural exercises that we are teaching here, some attention is paid to this side of the yogic science, the results could be and would be much better. One has to utilize them, but one cannot be imprisoned by these processes. Afterwards, one with certain exaggerations, which are very natural to the human mind in ignorance, one tends to look upon the asanas and the pranayama as things by themselves. It must always be remembered that an asana is a means, a pranayama is a means, even as meditation is a means. Meditation is not an end in itself. Meditation is important, concentration is important, because it can bring about certain results, certain states of consciousness, which are favorable to the reception of the higher vibrations, to tune yourself to the higher diviner consciousness. So my answer is, it depends upon each person how much attention he gives to this preliminary aspect of the matter, but an important aspect. This preliminary precaution, if it is taken, it reduces the labor very much.
Important what you're saying. And is it also possible, since we are interested not only in the integral yoga, but in the yoga of transformation, when even the cell shall remember, is it possible that researches can be done in a hatha yoga directed toward the transformation?
It is the research is, hatha yoga provides the easiest field of all the lines of yoga for experimental research. And most of the researches that are at present being conducted by American scientists in India are in the field of Hatha Yoga and Raja Yoga. Because they lend themselves on the physical plane, these changes of circulation, changes of vibrations and the speed of certain things, they can be recorded by material machines. So, lot of research has been done, which asana leads to what, which results. Demonstrable results, it has been recorded, and a lot of treatises have been written. If you read, there is the Light of Yoga by Iyengar. He has developed this science of Hatha Yoga and Raja Yoga in terms of modern thinking. You will see all the scientific data and everything is recorded there. How the pulse rate slows down, how the breathing changes, and then IQ, S and all those things have been recorded. I don't understand them, I have no interest in them. But changes in states of consciousness, the quality of consciousness, those things can't be registered in physical machines. You will have to evolve a more subtle instrument. To understand the state of your consciousness, I can understand only from the level of my consciousness. When I develop my consciousness into an instrument to receive impacts and relay them to me, to my perceiving intelligence, that will be the machine as far as consciousness is concerned. But the rest of it, the less subtle part of the matter can be researched into. But here, where it is a matter of consciousness, what in Indian systems we call the authentic word of experience, that has to be regarded. You can't insist upon a proof. That there is a knowledge which is empirical. Indian science of knowledge speaks of three or four categories. One is empirical knowledge, proof, experiment, and you see the results and codify that knowledge. There is a knowledge by inference. This has happened, when this happened, at that time this happened. You observe it 100 times, then you say, when this happens, this is going to happen. Or when this has happened, that must be the cause. That is what is called an inferential knowledge. Then there is the knowledge of authentic world, the experience. A person has a great experience and he sees. His very word carries the conviction. When you don't have the experience, and if you find that he is otherwise honest, straightforward, truthful, when he says of something which you don't, which you have not experienced, it stands to reason that we accept his word. Here in matters of consciousness, when we don't have those states of consciousness, we accept their word carries the weight. How many of us have experienced the supramental or the overmental consciousness? Why do we accept Mother and Sri Aurobindo's word in these matters? It's convincing. It carries conviction. The very words are loaded with their experience. They come like bullets and you feel it can't be otherwise. They can't be, you can't make researches into that with the present instruments. When you evolve different instruments, you can. Each order of reality has its own order of means of verification.
Yes.
counter. Mother said that on such occasions one must stay absolutely quiet without participating in the movement of anger on the other. In this sense, that even when you react saying that it is not so, when you challenge that person, you participate in his movement of anger. At that time, she said that you have to be absolutely quiet. Think of peace, call in peace, let him spend himself out. But if you are to contradict, if you are to point out that he is unreasonable, well, you participate in his movement of anger and it thrives. One has to literally close oneself. Then even if the impact takes place, it is on the superficial layers and it just dies out. One has, as in many other things, one has to be conscious. If one is conscious, there is an automatic bolting of the door. One doesn't let it in. Movements of anger, movements of envy, movements of passion, they all strike. But if we are cool, quiet, they cannot enter. If we are nervous, if we react, they can. Wisdom is not to react in any way.
If you try and keep this attitude, you make him even more angry because it seems hardly.
If one is for the right attitude for a spiritual seeker, that if one has provoked another person by one's own failure, one has to admit it immediately, and the anger immediately dies down. One has to admit honestly that I am sorry, I have done it. Please excuse me. The thunder is stolen. He may, you know, go on shouting for some time, but he loses the things. One has to. But if one is angry without justification, really there can't be justification for anger, but if one is angry, mother said humorously once, take a cup of water and give it to him first. And tell him that we will talk after you finish this glass of water. By the time he finishes, his anger would have gone down. No. There is... Because meditation in our yoga is not done only while sitting. One can meditate when one walks, one can meditate when one runs, one can meditate when one stands. Meditation is a sort of a concurrent process as one develops. So in the very nature of things, there can't be a fixed position of hands. Though in the ancient texts, it is mentioned that some positions of fingers sitting like this and all that, they conduce a favorable movement in the system. For those who find it necessary, certainly they can be utilized. But there is no such, they are called mudras. The position, the placing of fingers in certain ways, they attract certain occult movements and they contribute favorably. These are all part of rituals. Usually during worship and all that, they do it. They may have been necessary at a certain stage in the development of the human mind, the human system, the human emotions. But today, psychologically, man has developed so much that these outer means of ritual, elaborate postures, are not so indispensable. Mother, I have seen, normally mother would not give much importance to these things. She always laid stress on development of consciousness, the right attitude, to be vigilant. She always laid stress on the psychological side. But all of a sudden, many times I have seen mother suddenly saying that for this purpose the asanas are good, for this purpose pranayama they say is good. I have seen mother recognizing their role in particular situations. Though as a rule she was not minded to consider them as anything much in her scheme of things. But she was aware of the whole system. And I remember there was an occasion when Madame David Neal, she wrote to her from France. She was mother's friend in the earlier days. She once wrote saying, what is the position of pranayama in your yoga? What do you think in your school regarding pranayama? So mother called three or four of us and asked us to give notes as to what is pranayama from our standpoint, what use it has. I think three or four of us, Pavitra was there. I do not remember whether it was Nalini, I was asked. I didn't write anything of my own at that time. I gave excerpts from Sri Aurobindo's writings in the synthesis. And I believe she was very much satisfied. And she sent all the typed notes to her. Her attitude in such matters was, if that is your cup of tea, you have it. I suppose it is what we call in modern terms auto-suggestion. See, auto-suggestion. You go on suggesting to it. You are behaving like this, you should behave like that. You separate yourself from this body, from the vital, from the mental things. You take your position as the Purusha and then go on putting suggestions. And your will it is easier to do that way than when you are identified with these parts. So they speak of separate yourself from nature and then educate the various parts and limbs of nature to fall in line. In Buddhist literature, I believe these things have been worked out to very minute detail, that one is lost in that only, ultimately. In this sense, that the energies are directed in the direction, in the place you want. Normally, a system gets ill in a particular part, either due to faulty functioning or inadequate supply of life force there. By these exercises, it is possible to become conscious of those parts and direct the stream of life energy in those areas. To that extent, it is possible. But I believe there are also processes for reversing or modifying the flow of blood and flow of energies. They are all intricate processes. And they do take the help of Ayurveda, the Indian system of medicine from roots, leaves and such herbs. They utilize it as a subsidiary help. These processes take a lot of time. These advanced processes of Hatha Yoga and Raja Yoga, they take a lot of time, consume a lot of energy, and they leave little time for anything else. Modern science has developed various ways of effecting the cures rapidly. Microscopic element of time, and it is wiser to take advantage of modern science where it is not harmful to the system and devote the time so gained to the higher pursuit instead of being always occupied with the body's illnesses and indispositions. There should be a sense of proportion. Whether the amount of energy that I spend, the amount of time that I utilize is worth, in the overall perspective, whether it is worth what I am doing. That perspective shall never be lost. The purpose for which we are doing things, that should not be lost sight of. That is a characteristic contribution of Sri Aurobindo in the mind. To look at things in the totality, a global view of things.